My name is Edgar Mannheimer, and this is Kalam, a podcast about the Middle East.
You know, the scenes of the Iraqi prisoners covered with this sack
in Abu Ghraib.
From the Abu Ghraib, exactly, were very shocking for the Palestinian community, because this is the way how the Palestinian prisoners were treated since 67.
That was the Palestinian human rights lawyer, Sahar Francis, who we'll hear more from in just a second. But first, I'd like to thank you for your support. This podcast is nothing without its listeners. And from Sweden to Egypt to the US and even Malawi, we're honored to have you with us. We'd like to remind you that if you want to support us, you can do so by joining our Patreon community for just $3 a month at patreon.com/kalampodcast. There, you'll gain access to full-length interviews with all our guests, poetry and reading lists, and bonus episodes and material. Another way to support us is to subscribe and to rate the show in whatever podcast application you're listening on right now. It helps other people find out about us. Now, on to the program.
توحشني كماذا توحشني والصور التذكارية توحشني مكتبتي ونسى حياتي توحشني صحبة عودي يوحشني قبق القهوة يغرقني في بحر النشوة ركض الوقت وخلفني ربي لا تجعلني عبئا أنتظر بلوغي أرض الصمت طالت دربي يا ربي يوجعني الحكم الصهيوني يوجعني لا بل يقتلني وحدي مع ظلي في الدار.
I miss you as you miss me so much, and souvenir photos. I miss my library, forget my life. I miss Rodi's company. I miss the smell of coffee. Drown me in a sea of ecstasy. Time ran and left me behind. Lord, do not make me a burden, waiting for me to reach the land of silence. My path has been long, my Lord. The Zionist rule hurts me. It hurts me, even kills me, alone with my shadow at home. This is an excerpt from Fadwa Tuqan's poem, Longing, inspired by the law of gravity. Fadwa Tuqan died in Nablus, her city of birth, in 2003 at the age of 86, at the height of the Second Intifada, the topic of today's episode. She was born in 1917, the same year the British pledged to create the State of Israel in Palestine. Her poetry explores resistance to Zionist oppression, as well as the Palestinian patriarchal society she was born into. The former Israeli Defense Minister, General Moshe Dayan, once described the experience of reading her poetry to confronting 20 enemy commandos. The Second Intifada was not the same pacifist movement as the First Intifada had been. Armed struggle against the Israeli occupation forces, as well as bombings targeting Israeli civilians, has since marked the Second Intifada as especially bloody and brutal. This is also when the conservative and conspiratorial Islamist political movement Hamas gains popularity. But as we'll soon hear from Sahar Francis, this was largely a product of the desperation felt by the Palestinians after the failure of the Oslo Accords. The Oslo process, which lasted 7 years, was a net loss for the Palestinians. This may sound surprising for many in the West, but it did not achieve any of the aims of the Palestinian people and instead effectively employed Palestinians in enforcing their own occupation. Without going into too many details, this is what happened. The grassroots women's movement of the First Intifada we heard about last episode, spearheaded by people like Hanan Ashrawi, began negotiating with Israelis and Americans for a two-state solution. The negotiations stalled because the Israelis would not budge on three key issues: the release of all Palestinian prisoners, halting the construction of settlements, and guaranteeing a Palestinian state. Then, seemingly out of nowhere, a separate negotiation channel was opened, in secret, between the Yasser Arafat-led PLO leadership in Tunisia and the Israelis via negotiators in Oslo, the capital city of Norway.
The Norwegian government shocks the world. For months, it seems, Foreign Minister Holst has been secretly hosting direct talks between the Israeli government and the PLO.
The official negotiators had no idea secret talks were underway. Fewer than a dozen people knew.
It's been pointed out by many involved in the peace process at the time that the Israelis took advantage of the fact that the PLO in Tunisia were more keen on signing a deal, any deal, in order to return to Palestine as heroes than signing a good deal. So the deal was made, Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin shook hands in the US, and everyone lived happily ever after. Right? No. Palestinians found themselves living under a system where Israel essentially subcontracted Yasser Arafat and the newly established Palestinian Authority, the PA, to enforce its occupation. Settlements kept being built, Palestinians who resisted kept getting arrested, and it all culminated in the siege of several Palestinian cities in the early 2000s, including Arafat's headquarters in Ramallah. That is how Yasser Arafat spent the last years of his life, under house arrest or confined to the city of Ramallah, until his health deteriorated so severely that he was airlifted to a hospital in France, where he died in 2004. That doesn't sound like the president of a free nation to me. At the same time, the religious dimensions of the conflict were intensifying. Many say that the immediate spark of the Second Intifada came when the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon made a provocative trip to Al-Aqsa, the third holiest place in Islam and the location of the old Hebrew temple. It was long agreed that Israelis would not visit Al-Aqsa to pray, despite it technically occupying this territory. Sharon's visit galvanized support for Hamas, which exploited the increasing turn to religion when secular politics and politicians had failed the Palestinians time and time again. Hamas, which was founded in 1987, right at the start of the First Intifada, had secretly been supported by Israel since it split the Palestinian resistance in two. By the early 2000s, Hamas was a serious contender in Palestinian politics. This is also the time when the War on Terror was launched by the US following the 9/11 attacks in New York. Never before had the term terrorist been used so freely. Never before had it justified invading entire countries and arbitrarily arresting anyone without formal charge. From Washington to Tel Aviv, the term terrorist has since all but lost its meaning. The Palestinian rap group Dam expresses this frustration in their breakout hit Min Erhabi, Who's a Terrorist? I'm a terrorist? How am I a terrorist while I live in my own country? Who's a terrorist? You're a terrorist. You're swallowing me while I live in my country. Sahar Francis is a Palestinian human rights defender and the general director of Palestinian human rights organization Adamir, a Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association. Sahar is a lawyer and has worked for years promoting human rights in the face of Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territory. Sahar, thank you for your important work and welcome to the Kalam podcast.
Hello, and thanks for inviting me to share with you today.
So we're going to get into the Second Intifada in just a little bit, but I'd like to begin by asking you about the situation for Palestinians in Israeli jails, as this is an issue you've done extensive work on, and a lot has been made lately about the Israeli hostages in Gaza right now, rightly so, but it has been pointed out by many that Israel effectively keeps hostages as well, since Palestinians in the occupied territories live under military law and can be arrested without being charged, even minors. So please speak a little bit about this situation.
It's very important to clarify that the Israeli occupation is using the whole military system that imposing on the occupied territories, that includes the military courts and the military orders and the policies of arrest and imprisonment, as a tool to maintain the oppression and the control and to maintain the occupation, actually. And this is how they were using and weaponizing the ability to arrest thousands since the beginning of the occupation till today. Of course, whenever there's tension on the ground, like in the first intifada, in the second intifada, and currently after the 7th of October, the level of arrest increase in very sharp way. So far, for example, after the 7th till today, there's more than 8,000 people that they were arrested. Already before the 7th, we had 5,000 Palestinian prisoners inside the Israeli prisons. And of course, this is included children, women, administrative detainees, journalists, students, political activists, political leaders, everyone could be subjected for imprisonment. The level of the detention after the 7th increased in a very serious way, with a mass arrest campaign that targets almost everyone. Just this morning, the Israeli occupation forces arrested two previous female prisoners that they were subjected for imprisonment under administrative detention or charged for their studential activism in the past. Currently, we don't know. Most probably, they would be sent for administrative detention. And the administrative detention, as just you said, these are thousands of people arrested without any charges, without any clear evidences about what's the crime that they did. They are just held basically based on secret information. Their detention could be renewed indefinitely. These detainees could spend years in detention without being aware why they are arrested. So currently there's more than 3,500 administrative detainees, including children under 18, including women, including political leaders and students, and journalists and human rights defenders, that they are subjected for administrative detention. And of course, the situation for the prisoners in the prisons deteriorated seriously after the 7th of October in all levels, the health levels, the daily life of the prisoners. So far, 14 prisoners lost their lives out of severe torture and force, using force against them, or health neglect policies.
One of those prisoners was Waleed Daqqa, who died earlier this week at the age of 62 after spending 39 years in Israeli custody. His formal charge was belonging to an organization that had killed an Israeli soldier in 1984. He was set to be released last year, but his sentence was extended after he was accused of smuggling a cell phone to another prisoner, despite him having terminal bone marrow cancer. He wrote several books during his time in prison. Here's a quote from Melting of Consciousness from 2010. "There is nothing more intense and harsh than living with a sense of oppression and suffering without being able to describe it or identify its cause and source. It is the feeling of helplessness and the loss of human dignity when uncertainty meets oppression, making you feel that not only the world has abandoned you, but also your language has failed you in describing and defining your agony." Amnesty International and several other human rights organizations urged Israel to release him on medical grounds.
And from Gaza, of course, the thousands that they are arrested from Gaza, we don't know much about their conditions because They are literally disappearing inside the detention facilities.
Yeah.
But the Israeli media reported last week about 27 cases of people who lost their lives inside the Israeli detention facilities from the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, we don't know much, but we have certain testimonies when it comes to the prisoners in Gaza. One very high profile one is Musab Abu Toha, who even wrote in The New Yorker about his completely terrifying experience. Him obviously not having any connection to Hamas at all or any kind of political party. Sahar Francis, I'd like to ask you about the topic of this this episode. Last episode of the Kalam podcast, we spoke about the First Intifada, which was a largely nonviolent movement led mainly by women. And the Second Intifada has a much sort of darker and murkier reputation, since, as the renowned Palestinian historian Rashid Khalidi puts it, Palestinian armed factions began competing with each other for the best suicide and car bombings. You were there at the time. What was it like, the Second Intifada?
Of course, I was here working as a lawyer with a Damir, and it should be highlighted that the Second Intifada started as well as a grassroots movement, with people going out to the streets demonstrating, very similar to the actions of the First Intifada. But of course, it was a total different context.
Yeah.
The Palestinian Authority was already established. There were lots of Palestinian security, and because, you know, there's no army for the Palestinian Authority, but there were the Preventive Security Force 17 and lots of other armed groups that they were involved, not
yeah.
just the Palestinian armed struggle with the occupation forces that targeted as well the occupation forces.
Yeah.
In the meaning that it wasn't a peaceful resistance, but also the fact that the Israelis, as well the Israeli occupation forces, were raiding and reoccupying the Palestinian cities in March 2002, made it more complicated and more dangerous. And then there were direct clashes, actually, when they for example, the siege over the Jenin refugee camp
mm-hmm.
that ended in destroying and demolishing lots of the houses and killing lots of people in the refugee camp. So the level of violence were very different from what happened in the First Intifada. Also, on the level of the imprisonment, it was the highest number of the Palestinian prisoners in the Second Intifada, where in one moment we reached 11 and 12,000 people arrested. Like in this March of 2002, when the occupation forces raided the Palestinian cities in the occupied territories, they launched mass arrest campaign that reached more than 15,000 Palestinian men who were arrested in less than 1 month, kept in military detention facilities and in prisons under the Prison Service Authority. And this was the time, for example, when they opened Ofer prison. Ofer wasn't a prison. Ofer was a military camp for vehicles that they didn't have enough place to host all these thousands that they were arresting. So they invented Ofer to be a detention facility. At the first 2 months, they kept people in the garage that it was used for tanks.
Mm.
One side totally opened, 700 people were squeezed inside this place, sleeping on the ground with very, very difficult conditions. And there was a sharp increase in the level of sentences because the Courts started to impose very high sentences for actions that before were not reaching such levels. So it really, on the level of the imprisonment and the prisoners and the difficulties that the prisoners faced in the Second Intifada, where I would say a station where things started to change from the strategies, the policies of the treatment of the prisoners as well, how much the prison system and the army started to make the conditions more difficult, and the failure of the hunger strike, for example, in 2004, that the prisoners initiated, reflects how difficult the situation was to push any kind of resistance within the prisoners' movement at that time.
You mentioned earlier the war on terror. This all is taking place in the early 2000s, the late 90s, early 2000s, and that at that time a lot was happening. 9/11 happened. The US was gearing up to invade Iraq. There was a global protest movement against that war, and in many Arab countries that protest movement was linked to the Second Intifada and the solidarity with Palestine. How were all these things felt in Palestine at the time?
Of course, the anti-terror and all the legislations and the campaign that started in the US were a kind of very huge support to the Israeli policies at the end, because Israel took advantage of this moment of the September 11th in order to convince and to distribute their theory about how states should fight terrorism, because the first claim from their side was, this is what we were trying to tell you all these decades. Israel is the only democracy that is facing terrorism every day. So on the level of the legal developments in how to use secret information, how to use torture and techniques of torture, and how to obtain confessions out of torture and to be used later on the trials, you know, the scenes of the Iraqi prisoners covered with this sack.
In Abu Ghraib.
From the Abu Ghraib, exactly.
Abu Ghraib was a notorious prison in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which was taken over by Americans when they invaded the country and toppled Saddam's regime. One of the biggest scandals of the war was when photographs of American prison guards torturing, humiliating, and sexually abusing Iraqi prisoners were leaked to the media. Sahar Francis is saying here that the Palestinians were shocked to recognize many of these tactics, which they claim Israel had used against them as well.
Very shocking for the Palestinian community, because this is the way how the Palestinian prisoners were treated since 67. This sack, the cloth sack, this was one of the main tools that were used in the interrogation, in the torture, because this sack is not just a sack to cover your eyes. It's something that will not enable you to breathe normally because it's very thick. It's the smell is awful, because the Palestinian detainees were reporting that they were like feeling the dirt of the sack. They couldn't breathe. And if you are sitting tied in a very painful position in a small chair 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for continuously 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and this sack is on your head, they take it off just when you go to the toilet, you will lose your sense of time, of the place, of, and this is part of the torture that was used in the Israeli interrogation centers for a long time. So actually, the level of torture against the Palestinian prisoners after the war in Iraq were increasing, and they were kind of receiving a green light that they can do whatever they want with the Palestinian prisoners without much criticism, because the US is doing much worse with the Iraqi prisoners or with other prisoners in Guantanamo or in Abu Ghraib. And as well, on the level of the solidarity, we felt there were, yes, increased solidarity with the Palestinian people in these years. And this was one of the main reasons why the Palestinian civil society in 2004 initiated the boycott, divestment, and sanction campaign. Yeah. It was in 2004. Where the Palestinian civil society decided that it's the right time to invest in all this international solidarity with the Palestinian cause and to direct it for a very intense action plan that could cause some pressure on the occupation. Because to be honest, we didn't felt, especially because the ICJ ruling came in the same time around the wall, the International Court for yeah. Justice decision, although it wasn't a binding decision, it was a more as a judicial opinion from the court about the wall and the illegality of the wall. But this is reflects the failure of the international law system to impose on the occupation to respect the international law and their obligation according to the international law. And this is why we decided that the pressure from the people, from the civil society on their countries maybe will change the reality. And this is how things developed on the level of the actions and the call for the boycott, divestment, and sanction.
Yeah. This is also the era when Hamas gains more serious popularity. And in 2005, of course, they win the election in Gaza. How did you experience this rising political force of Hamas?
Of course, the support for Hamas from the Palestinian people came after the failure of the Palestinian Authority, actually, to convince people that the Oslo agreement is effective and working and able to put an end for the Israeli occupation. And it came after the horrible experience in the Second Intifada. And I don't recall now what was the percentage of the people who shared in the election, but yeah. This was totally connected to that time, to the failure of the Palestinian Authority to bring the peace that people were looking for. Yeah. But we cannot forget the reaction of the international society, how they decided to boycott the elected government, where the UN side or the objective group that monitored the occupation, the election, confirmed that the process was very accurate process that reflected really the will of the people, that it was transparent election process.
For our Swedish listeners, former Prime Minister Carl Bildt of the conservative party Moderaterna was one of the election observers and famously said it was the most democratic election process he'd ever seen.
And still the world decided to punish the Palestinian people for their democratic choice, and they boycotted the government. So then a unity government was but still Israel decided to continue to punish the Palestinian democratic choice. And this is another point that should be highlighted, that Hamas didn't run to the election under the name of Hamas. There was a party that called the Reform and the Change, and some of the members in the Reform and the Change were independent, were not Hamas activists from before. But Israel arrested most of them, especially from the West Bank, and they paralyzed the Palestinian parliament for all the years to come after. So even the fact that the Israeli occupation forces kept the security in their hand under their jurisdiction, this enables them to arrest anyone, to raid any city, irrelevant to the existence of the Palestinian Authority, whether it's controlled by Hamas or controlled by Fatah or any other party. The fact that Israel still have the power to force it on the ground, this is, was the most important thing that they used in order to affect the political life of the Palestinian people. And this is done in a very brutal way now, where they are still continuing to raid all the Palestinian areas, all the Palestinian cities, even Ramallah, where it's the main city of the Palestinian Authority. And the Palestinian Authority can do nothing about this.
Yeah. These historical events are so linked. Let's focus a little bit on Oslo. There's a misconception in the West, I think, where people say that Oslo was a perfect process, and it was the big, beautiful peace deal for the Middle East. And then when you ask, so what happened? Why did it fail? People don't really know, but I think generally people think that, oh well, I think that the Arabs were too stubborn or something. So what was Oslo? And can one really speak about it failing, or was it problematic to begin with?
It was problematic to begin with, unfortunately. And this is like, there was opposition to Oslo internally, even in Fatah, in the main political party who signed the Oslo agreement. There was a split around Oslo. Not all Fatah members were supporting the Oslo process, because I think every Palestinian who reviewed the agreement itself, we should, as a lawyer, I'm sorry to say, I have to go into the details of this agreement.
Please do. Yeah.
And if you go into the details about the agreement, the Oslo 1 and Oslo 2 and all the agreements that were signed after, it wasn't done in a way that really can guarantee the freedom of the Palestinian people and establishing a Palestinian state. For example, on the level of the prisoners, mm-hmm. you know that the first agreement didn't include any exchange deal with the prisoners. And there were more than 1,500 prisoners in the Israeli prisons in that time. And this is what brought the prisoners to open a hunger strike for the first time in their history as a movement against, for political motivation, against the Palestinian Authority that didn't include them in the agreement. And this is why in the Washington agreement, in the second Oslo agreement, the issue of the prisoners were included. But, and again, the case of the prisoners can reflect the intentions of the Israeli side. Israel started to put conditions on the release of the prisoners. They categorized the prisoners for elderly prisoners, sick prisoners, minors, women, those who are sentenced for life sentences, those that they are sentenced for more than 20 years. So they didn't agree to release all of the prisoners irrelevant to what they were sentenced or what they did. Because if you compare, for example, with the Good Friday Agreement or any other release that came associated with a peace process in South Africa, in Ireland, in other contexts in the world,
I think comparing the Palestinian peace process with other such processes in history is helpful. Two successful examples being Northern Ireland and South Africa, because it exposes the huge differences. Long before the 7th of October, Israel and the international community decided to boycott Hamas. Say what you will about this movement, which certainly I am no friend of, but it was democratically elected. In Northern Ireland, the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, committed the same kinds of bloody attacks as Hamas against British civilians, even killing children when they bombed buses and restaurants. But in the end, the Good Friday Agreement, heralded by many Western liberals as a major success, included the IRA. The same grace is not extended to the Palestinian people.
If you have good intentions to do peace, you wouldn't put limitations and conditions on the release of the prisoners. Yeah. You admit that prisoners should be released if you wanna do a real peace with the other side. So Israel knew. And Netanyahu, who was the prime minister at that time, started to stop the release of the different groups whenever he claimed that the PA is not fulfilling the Oslo Agreement.
Yeah.
This is just one example that can reflect the intentions with the Israeli side about the Oslo process. Within the 7 years or so that the Oslo process was done, they never stopped the settlements.
Yeah.
And they were enabling themselves, according to the Oslo Agreement, to keep the control, like the division of the Palestinian territory for Area A, B, C, in the Oslo Agreement, reflects these intentions that they were never intending really to give the whole area to the Palestinian Authority. It was justified from their side, of course, for security needs. But I think 30 years now after, we can for sure say why this was a very bad agreement from the beginning. And this is why the Second Intifada actually came, because it was clear for the Palestinian people that this is not peace, that the Israelis are not really going to end their occupation.
Yeah. I mean, it must have struck the Palestinians as sort of horrifyingly absurd to see the world applauding a peace deal. And you see Arafat and Rabin shaking hands. And yet there is no Palestinian state. The settlers are simply are expanding. The prisoners are not released. And effectively, the PA have become an arm of the Israeli occupation, or a tool of the Israeli occupation, effectively enforcing it.
And add on top the commercial agreement, the Paris Agreement, that made the Palestinians exploited by the occupation side, and we're feeding into their economy. Like all the financial agreement between the PA and the Israelis were in favor of the occupiers, not for the interest of the people and their occupation. So it was clear for the Palestinian people that this is just binding on the Palestinian side, not binding on the Israeli side. And totally, I agree with your conclusion that the PA ended up being the subcontractor, or the especially when you take the issue of the security coordination. This was one of the most difficult, and still a very difficult, subject in the internal Palestinian context, where the PA, and especially because of the internal arrests and torture and imprisonment of those who were opposing the Oslo process, who were opposing the PA, and were acting against Israel. They were arrested by the Palestinian Authority, and they were tortured, and they were imprisoned. So, and when they would be released, some of these people were re-arrested by the Israeli side. So, and it's not a secret that there is security coordination between both sides, and people were criticizing the Palestinian Authority for this role.
Yeah. The Second Intifada sparked huge protests across the Arab world, not the least in Egypt. And Professor Khaled Fahmy, who I interviewed in the third episode we did on the Kalam podcast about the Six-Day War in 1967, he claims that it was this solidarity movement with Palestinians taking place in Egyptian cities that then led to the mass movement in 2011, toppling the dictatorial Mubarak regime. In light of this, what do you think is the legacy of the Second Intifada when we think about it today?
The PDS movement. I think this decision of the Palestinian civil society to call for actions for civil societies in the Arab world and beyond, like in the global level, to support Palestine via making these links on the level of the oppressors and the policies, the strategies, because the boycott, the call for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions started to be as well a movement in these countries, whether in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Morocco, in Jordan, in other neighboring countries. I think this is was very important to open eyes for the people that we can joint efforts in order to fight, for example, on the level of security companies. G4S, one of the security companies that in the international level is involved in lots of Arab countries around security technology, about being involved in prisons, in other contexts. So when the Palestinian civil society started the campaign against G4S, this is a subject where easily Moroccan activists can associate and collaborate and coordinate, because this company is active in Morocco and are involved in violation of human rights. So I think this is what really developed after the call of PDS, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And I think, yes, we can say, I don't want to say that it was the only and the main reason, no, but I think it supported the initiatives in the Arab world for the democratic change and the uprisings.
Yeah. Sahar Francis, thank you so much for being a guest on the Kalam podcast and taking time away from your important schedule, I can imagine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was the human rights lawyer Sahar Francis, general director of the Palestinian human rights organization Adamir, and the fifth episode of the Kalam podcast series on Palestine. I hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we're going to look at Gaza today, in light of the atrocities we have been witnessing for the past 6 months. And I'm so pleased to announce that the renowned Palestinian poet Mus'ab Abu Toha will be a guest on the Kalam podcast. Mus'ab was evacuated from his hometown in Gaza in December 2023 and has since been published in the New York Times and the New Yorker and appeared on programs such as Democracy Now! That's next week on the Kalam podcast. Kalam was written and hosted by me, Edgar Mannheimer. Research and production by Sam Karl Samra. Poetry reading in Arabic by Khulud Saghir. And sound design by Arthur Mannheimer.